Is December 2nd, right? Wednesday, December 2nd, 2009. And I hope today to start talking about an important subject for practice in many ways, sexuality. First, though, I wonder if anybody had any comment about the instructions I gave or suggestions I gave at the beginning of meditation, which are kind of neurologically informed instructions, and I wondered how they landed for you. I don't normally give that many, but every so often I think it's helpful to kind of run through the basics. All right, Nancy.
Well, this may be off the subject, but I don't know the foggiest concept of what people mean by compassion for yourself or love yourself. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a big waste of time.
All right.
I don't sit around thinking about how I can love myself. I do certain things and take care of certain things because I was just raised in the kind of environment where you had to toe the line until you were 30 years old.
Yeah.
You get punished.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's respect for yourself. I don't think so. But I don't have it. I think it's the way, I'm not going to sit around thinking about how to love myself. I have compassion for myself and then it's silly.
Okay. Well, I'd say a couple of things. First is that it's a really wonderful kind of point slash question to consider. Second, it is divergent from, you know, how are the suggestions working for you, but which is completely fine with me. I just want to acknowledge that. I think it's a great question. And one, everyone is entitled to do what they want to do, basically, particularly in terms of non-harming other people. As the Buddha said repeatedly, see for yourself. So what I'm about to say, really, see for yourself. The view within Buddhism is that, first of all, to define terms, compassion boils down to the wish that beings not suffer. It's as simple as that. It is not airy-fairy. It's a matter of intention or will. It's the wish that they not suffer, usually accompanied by a certain warmth and sense of connection with those other people. So that's what compassion is. Kindness is more the wish that they be happy, right? Compassion arises in response typically to the suffering of others, including very subtle suffering, ranging from a kid's owie to our friend's worry about their, you know, pension because their company's going through a lot of trouble, to the feelings we have toward a loved one who's in the last few days of their life, right? So that's what compassion is. Kindness doesn't have to be moved by suffering. Kindness can arise under any condition, either the suffering of others or the happiness of others. Okay? Now, traditionally, there are five objects of to whom compassion should be directed, or five kinds of people toward whom compassion should be directed. And the word should there is not a moralistic should, it's a pragmatic should. In other words, the notion is that it helps move us in the path of practice. It helps relieve our suffering, and it helps us cause fewer harms to ourselves if we have compassion for benefactors, people who have really done a lot for us that we have gratitude for. Friends, which is very broadly defined, could mean spouses, children, pets, neighbors, lifetime best friends, what have you. Three, neutral people, including people we know, like the guy who makes our sandwich at the deli, to complete strangers. We just don't know. Passing on the street, or we know they exist, we have no idea what their faces are like or their names. In Johannesburg, South Africa, or Bismarck, North Dakota. Fourth, difficult people, sometimes called enemies, certainly difficult people. For example, people who we feel have wronged us and never cop to it. Political figures we don't like. It's often hard for people these days. Difficult people. And last and not least, oneself. So that's the view within the Dharma. Now, whether you subscribe to that view or not, you know, as the Buddha said, see for yourself, but at least that's the general Buddhist view. Now, why might compassion for oneself actually be useful within a frame of movement toward greater happiness, love, and wisdom, and away from unhappiness, ill will, hatred, broadly defined, and ignorance? Right? How might self-compassion help? It's interesting these days, and it was a hot topic in England, that self-compassion is a hot topic of research. I don't know how many of you get this weekly newsletter I put out called Just One Thing, which has a practice each week. The practice last week was have compassion for yourself, and I listed a lot of the reasons why, which you know might be worth taking a look at if you haven't seen that. For example, it's found in research that self-compassion, which is not self-pity, it's a simple quality of, gee, I wish I didn't suffer. It's a recognition of our own discomfort and pain. It's not blaming the world, it's not blaming ourselves. It's very simple. It's a recognition of pain, broadly defined, or difficulty. It's goodwill toward oneself as one of the all beings in this world to have goodwill toward. And there's an emotional quality of warmth and concern. That's what self-compassion is. It's just that. It's not a straw man. In other words, it's just that. And researchers have found that self-compassion promotes resilience and the ability to deal with the hard knocks of life, that it interestingly adjusts the heartbeat and heart rate variability in a pattern which is kind of smoothly varying between short and long intervals between beats, which is associated with a stronger immune system and greater cardiovascular health over the lifespan. So literally, by having compassion for oneself, researchers have found that one promotes one's physical health, which is a pretty good foundation, you know, for practice and, you know, movement on the path of awakening. The longer you live, the more steps you can take down that path, just kind of, you know, mechanically speaking. Self-compassion, interestingly, primes the neural circuits of bringing compassion to others. So, for example, by getting on our own side, for starters, it actually gives us more inside. It fills up our own cup, so we have more to offer to other people. Interestingly, one of the areas of research that I find particularly fascinating is this idea that inside people are three motivational systems. There's an approach system, you know, pursue carrots. There's an avoidance system, duck sticks. We share those with the crocodiles, the snakes, the frogs, the turtles, the wasps, you know, we right, approach or avoid. But then there's a very special system that only mammals and birds have. It's the affiliation system. It's the system that bonds and attaches to loved ones, and through bonding and attaching, feels contented and safe, refueled, and on the basis of that secure base, ready to launch out and explore and engage and master the world. That's the affiliation system. Isn't that fascinating? And it uses the affiliation system, the attachments. You see that as an attachment system in young children, in parents with kids. You see it with lovers. You see it with friends. We affiliate. It overlaps with the approach-avoid system. In other words, we resist threats to our loved ones. We seek the rewards of how good it feels to be in love and to take care of other people or to receive their admiration, respect, liking, inclusion, and whatnot. But it's its own unique system. Interestingly, through that system is activated when we receive compassion from others, right? We feel close to them, we feel contented, we feel safe, we feel refueled. We often feel healed of what was in short supply when we were young in terms of nurturing attunement, right? But also, deep down in your brain, that affiliation system is also activated when you bring compassion to yourself. When you tune into yourself and give to yourself clear-eyed recognition of your own suffering, and you give to yourself good wishes that it change for the better, and you bring a kind of warmth to yourself, deep down in the brain, it doesn't know what the source is. It still sinks in, and that affiliation system is still activated with all of the benefits. And those are among the fruits of self-compassion.
Is that all you got?
Push play. Thank you. Thank you.
That's been good. I've gotten a lot out of self-compassion lately. You know, like my kind of rule of thumb is, pause, get on my own side, have compassion for myself, and make a plan. And that often will go down in the first 3 seconds, you know, right? Just kind of, that's where you kind of get centered and stabilized. Then you can move out into the world, you know. Okay. And then, so far it's just G-rated. Yeah, I don't know, you know. Yeah, go on.
Is not answering the original question?
Yeah, go for it.
I think one of the things that may trip people up with the self-compassion is the language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the I don't want to feel sorry for myself, and all the language without listing it taking up time. But I think that is a big part of it. So
yeah.
I respond to that.
Well, it's wonderful. What often comes up for people, and again, it's what you see in a lot of things, where you intellectually, maybe 1% of you knows that something would be good for you, right? Like says, oh, self-compassion would be good for me, or not kicking the dog would be good for me, right? Or looking for a different job would be good for me. Whatever it is, 1% recognizes that would be good for me. 99% of us says, no, right? And at that point, we practice with what? With the resistance, with the concern, with the reservation. In other words, as soon as you realize that, it would be valuable to bring to oneself in a simple way, very often for just seconds. It's not like people are wallowing in self-compassion. We're talking here about a mental event on the range of literally 5 to 10 seconds in duration, most of the time, if not even just 2 to 3 seconds, even if that. So it's... Yeah, and I wish it didn't hurt. I wish it didn't hurt. You know, and
this sucks.
This sucks. And I wish it didn't suck. And I'm concerned that it sucks. It's not just I'm a robot or a crocodile, right? Who like has that stance toward myself, but I'm a mammal toward myself. In other words, I have a sense of warmth and concern that it sucks. And then on the basis of that, I get up off the mat and I go do something, if only inside my head. I mean, self-compassion is the beginning of resilient, resourceful action. We don't stop with self-compassion, but very often people skip that step and then they try to embark on resilient, resourceful action, but they run out of gas because they haven't fed the roots. They haven't tended to the causes, you know. This is a very cause-focused tradition. We think about causes and effects a lot. And it's very pragmatic. What are the causes? You know, how's that working for you to not have self-compassion after all these years? How's that working for you too? Start with self-compassion. And then, you see for yourself. But so what stirs up for people often is the resistance against self-compassion. And that's very interesting to explore. For example, it includes a lot of internalized oppression, to borrow a term from diversity work. I don't know if you've ever heard that term, internalized oppression. It's the idea that you belong to a class of people that have been historically and in some ways currently oppressed. And that's an external source of oppression, yet it becomes internalized in terms of self-criticism, self-inhibition, self-hatred, or just the dismissal of possibilities for oneself. Right? That's something that we surface. Isn't that interesting? Sometimes also we surface, associated fear that if I open up to this, what was in most of my life an external source, if I open up to wanting it, I'll be hurt for asking for it, for being a bother, for showing weakness, for expressing my own needs when my brother's so sick, when my parents are going through a divorce, when my mom or dad is so depressed. You know, that I'll be, that in the sequence, the way the mind works is through sequences. Sequences of history form expectations now in the future. That there's the expectation that if I reach for it, I'll be hurt, even if I reach for it from myself. You know, because in the past, when I did reach for it, I was hurt. Or I saw someone else reach for it and get hurt over there. You know, so there are other things. I don't want to go too far here, but those are two, I think, really good examples. And one of the great broad principles of growth is is our cycles, where basically one of them is where we clarify in our mind, in our clear intellect, that something would be good for us. We take a step in that direction and see what gets surfaced. You know, we see the cloud of gnats, stinging gnats, that, you know, surface when we take a step in that direction. Then we work through them, and then we take another step. That's very effective. Right? We take action. It's great to take action, even in mental events. Those are forms of action as well. All right.
Karen.
Yeah.
I think in addition to what you just said about if you take, if I do self-compassion, then I won't maybe have fear of being rejected and reaching out for reasons. The other thing is maybe I won't go down the road of blaming myself or feeling guilty for whatever it is that I'm suffering. So it kind of prevents me from going back to
yeah.
the loop.
That's right.
And strengthens the other neural connection of feeling better about.
Yeah, thank you. That was well said. Completely agree. All right, Ozzy, and then let's somehow try to segue to sex.
We're still on the same subject. No, I just wanted to back that up. At a retreat at Spirit Rock a few weeks back, Donald Rossford did Transforming the Judgmental Mind.
Uh-huh.
Loving kindness, the compassion, what he called the heart practices, were a big part of that. And that's kind of the basis of the whole thing, at least that aspect of it, which is we all have a judgmental mind. I think that Buddha said that lasts till the fourth stage of awakening, so if you're judgmental, it just means you're not awake yet. But the idea was that's one of the ways to address the judgmental mind,
yeah.
was the heart practices and including yourself, because a lot of times we engage in judgment of people to make ourselves feel better or whatnot for,
yeah.
you know. So I think that's another reason, you know, if you're judgmental, then those are probably going to be pretty significant practices for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the research findings related to that is that a lot of the research on self-esteem kind of boils down to self-compassion, and that the elements of self-compassion, which tend to be quite emotional, heart-focused, actually often have more impact than the more kind of verbal, logical practices of self-esteem. I mean, I know a lot of people who know intellectually that they're a good person, they have abilities, they're not that bad a person, but deep down in their gut, they don't feel of much worth, and they don't feel that their own needs have much real standing. Part of the embedded, implicit message in self-compassion is your experience matters. You know, that's what you're saying to yourself. My experience matters. It matters enough for me to wish that it improve, and it matters enough to give tender concern and warmth to myself. That itself sends a wonderful and important message. Yeah. Okay. Is that okay? I mean, we could do more on this, but I think it's interesting to talk about sex, too. I was joking with Nancy when we both arrived. No, we were the first year no one was here. It was just a few minutes before. I thought, man, sex. You'd figure the more people would be here. But anyway. It is interesting that an area of life that definitely does warrant, I think, a certain amount of compassion for ourselves is the general domain of sexuality. So maybe that's not, you know, entirely random, you know, the connection between the two things. I just thought we couldn't get through a year of practice focused on relationships without addressing sexuality in some way. And so I want to, if I could, first of all, just read to you the essential teachings in the Pali Canon, what the Buddha, our best guess of what the Buddha himself specifically taught, not necessarily his exact words, but a pretty good approximation, much of the time at least, and then discuss that a bit, and then kind of broaden the whole inquiry, all right? And the frame here isn't how to have a better sex life, it's how to have better practice with your sex life. In other words, whatever, including having no sex life. Okay? So, the first off is, you may remember that in the Buddhist tradition, which is consistent also with many other paths of well-being and personal growth, it's understood that there's three fundamental pillars of practice. Virtue, concentration, you know, steadying the mind, mindfulness, and third, wisdom. Virtue, you know, sila, samadhi, and panya, you know, virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, So most of the Buddhist teachings about sex have to do with virtue, which right itself is very interesting, that he did not, I mean, he would include implicitly sexual feelings and the pleasant and unpleasant tone related to sex and thoughts and feelings related to sex in the four foundations of mindfulness, but he didn't particularly pull it out. He mostly regarded it as a domain where as skillful means, monastic practitioners, monks and nuns, would give up, just they would simply abstain from sex, like many other monastics or religious people do in other traditions. They would just abstain. And for householders, his advice about sex basically boiled down to one of the five precepts, which is non-harming. Don't harm others, and implicitly don't harm yourself through sexuality. So that's where we start. I want to start with the virtue pillar, but then move it out some into steadiness of mind applied to sexuality, mindfulness applied to sexuality, and then wisdom applied to sexuality. Okay? And just so we're clear on the terms, I'm using sexuality to mean that which pertains to sex, both the use of the sexual organs or activities, acts of, body, speech, and mind that are eroticized, right? If you hug a tree in Muir Woods and it's an erotic act for you, much like having sexual intercourse is an erotic act, okay, we'll call that sexuality. But I don't want to use sexuality so broadly. If it means everything, it means nothing. Okay? So this is what the Buddha said. Right off the top, remember the ancient, feudal, 2,500 years ago culture and the highly patriarchal nature of that culture. So, let's see. He says, and how householders, so he's talking to the householders, people like us, are there, different kinds of unrighteous bodily conduct? So he's going to talk about sex here. Conduct not in accordance with the Dharma. And I'll jump past killing and stealing to this person who is unrighteous, in other words, who is violating the precept, who is causing harm, commits sexual misconduct. He has intercourse with women who are protected by their mother, father, mother and father, brother, sister, or relatives, who have a husband, who are protected by law, and even with those already engaged. In other words, they're not married, but they're betrothed. That's it. Isn't that interesting? Just basically infidelity is the definition of sexual harm. And I want to just play with it here and genderize it the other way. She who violates the third precept commits sexual misconduct. She has intercourse with men who are protected by their mother, father, mother and father, brother, sister, or relatives, who have a wife, who are protected by law, and even with those already engaged. Okay, so that's where we start. We start with, don't be unfaithful. So right off the top, with Tiger Woods in the news these days, any comments so far? I suspect so. Someone who's in that culture, you're still living with your parents. Yeah.
But it's like relatives as well. Yeah. I'm curious about the meaning of it.
I think that as well. I think he's just being thorough. I'm not a scholar of that age, but that's my best understanding. You can update it almost to traditional tribal cultures in the hills of Pakistan, say, or traditional Indian culture today.
Yeah, but
our daughter in high school had a classmate who was living in a Western culture in San Rafael, who knew, and he was fine with it, that his parents would, select a bride for him in a few years, and he would marry her and live with her for the rest of his life, and so even today. Yeah, Ozzy, thank you.
Well, I guess I'm still on that. If you're just living with relatives, that doesn't necessarily, you could be 30, 35, 40 years. I mean, is that really meaning, are we talking about minors, or are we talking about something different?
I think in this setting, the little I know is that you're with, it's not, in that framework, it's not proper.
Right.
In other words, that's not a person who is available for sex.
But is that a social or a religious issue?
A great question. I think in that time, and then we have to decide, what do we update,
right?
What do we apply for today? I think the larger takeaway for each of us to ask ourselves is what to us feels harmful sexually. Here's where I kind of want to broaden it a little bit. And I want to toss out a couple of examples and then see what you think about those and then take it one step further. So what about engaging in sexual activity, which doesn't necessarily mean intercourse, because this could mean really intense flirting on the third or fourth date, when you know in your mind that what you're interested in is sex with that person, and you know that that person is interested in more, and you know you'll never be interested in more. And you also know that if you do have sex with that person, they're going to really want more, even more than ever, and be really more hurt than ever if they don't get more. Do you go ahead and have sex with that person? You're not leading them on, you're not lying to them, you're not cheating on them, but you know that at the end of the path you're on, you will yourself feel a fair amount of pleasure and they will feel a fair amount of pain.
Increasing suffering.
How do you feel about that? To me, that's very often the young man's dilemma. Sometimes the young woman's dilemma too, but you know, is that causing harm? Even though, you know, how do you think about that?
I think therein starts the game. Because, you know, in situations like that, a lot of times, I'll use an example, someone will say, well, you know, I know I'm not going to be able to commit, but if you want to. And women think, or say it's, if it's a man.
Yeah.
And a woman might think, oh, I'm the one that's going to change their mind. It's an age old game.
Sure.
And I mean, maybe I'm relating to our culture, but.
Yeah. I don't have a Rick ordained answer. I think it's a good question, though. Well, how about. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if. I don't know. I don't have any precepts to memorize that person.
Yeah. That's number four. Don't speak falsely. But again, they're all said in the frame of knots. Later on, I'm going to invert it. I'm going to ask what would cause benefit with sexuality. But yeah, number four is don't speak falsely. Go on.
Because if someone's interest is to awaken and be enlightened,
yeah.
If they're telling lies, even if it's by omission, you know, you're not going to have a quiet mind. And so it seems like they all tie together and that, you know, honesty would be right in line with that situation as opposed to sexual do's and do nots would be more an issue of honesty.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, in the back.
It also seems like it can have an effect, a detrimental effect on the person besides harming them. It might make them decide, oh, it's okay. You know, it's okay for me to be in this relationship. I can be all about fun too, and that takes them away from their own center, which is almost as bad as causing them suffering to take them away from what they really want out of life, as well as harming them when it all comes down to the end that we predicted from these two people.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Well, let me add a couple more irons to the fire and see what you think about these. I thought about three other kinds of self-harm, just to kind of raise, see what you think about them, related to sex. So besides infidelity of one kind or another, one thing that I see a lot about sexuality is the way that, partly because of the way we're wired, it becomes a very fixed object of craving. Oscar Wilde had a great line. He said, men are attracted by what they see, women by what they hear. Okay? There's not a whole industry. There's a whole industry producing intensely sexual imagery for men. There's no equivalent for women. On the other hand, there's an enormous industry generating romance novels for women
there's almost no equivalent for men. Right? And then the question becomes, to what extent does your own engagement with sexuality, with pornography, or with you know, fantasies of different kinds that may or may not, you know, have a pornographic quality to them, to what extent does that become something that the mind fixes on and has greed for, has craving for, which then creates suffering? That's a question. Another question is, to what extent is there completely uncalled for shame and guilt related to sexuality? I mean, there's a lot of people who have talked about what a, you know, Bernard may have more to say about this coming from another culture to America, but a fair amount of, you know, shame related to sexuality in America. And shame-based messages, kids who are playing with themselves, getting all kinds of messages, messages in the culture. If one is self-critical or shaming toward oneself, that's a form of self-harm. Interesting, related to sex. And it's often one we just take for granted. Maybe the opposite of a self-compassion, you know, in a sense, or one of the opposites to that. The last one is a form of self-harm. It's an interesting one, and there are probably others as well. These are three that occurred to me. The last one is simply blocking the flow of energy. I had a very interesting conversation with a woman who's a scholar of sexuality, especially for women. And she's about 50-ish plus, definitely someone who's been around the block, very bright. And she just mentioned research that talks about the amazing number of people, men and women alike, who are just simply unaware of sexual feelings inside their own body. Like literally, you'll show them pictures or things, and they'll say, not moving my needle, but to be blunt, their genital tissues will start engorging. If something's happening in their body, but they're just not aware of it. I always think it's so bizarre to imagine being a subject in a study like that, you know, like wiring you up in the nether regions, but science marches on one way or another. Anyway, so that too, you know, it's very interesting to just explore the degree to which we tighten. You know, Reich talked about this. We tighten, we block, we have armor, we impede the flow of healthy sensation and emotion moving through us. Okay, so what do you think about those three kinds of possible self-harm above and beyond infidelity?
Well, I will say, I was raised Catholic, and being a young man and having certain thoughts and doing certain things, and then you go to confession, and you feel shame. And, you know, from what I've heard, shame is one of the worst emotions that there is. So, you know, you have the cravings and whatnot, and you keep thinking about it, and you continue, and yet you feel bad about it. Because, you know, it's considered a sin of varying degree within the church. So I think for a lot of people who are raised Catholic, it can be difficult, and you feel a lot of shame.
I was not raised Catholic, but this was an unspeakable area in my family. So it was unspeakable. How much shame must be associated with something that's unspeakable? So I got the same thing you got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's shame.
How did you know how did you know within your family it was shameful?
Well, because it was forbidden. We didn't talk about it. It was not acknowledged because, well, I made that, I don't know, I made that connection that this must be pretty awful stuff if you can't comfortably talk about it.
Yeah. How many of us were immaculately conceived like I was? How many of us were immaculately conceived? That's how shameful it was in my family.
Yeah, so how is sexual shame a form of self-harming? You know, those are the kind of cuts that often go a lot deeper than, you know, a razor blade across the wrist.
Well, and that's just one slice of it. I mean, it does, you know, when you're talking about moralistic judgments, shaming, that whole cycle doesn't stop with sex, obviously. It's pervasive, right, in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
You know, once you kind of set up the conditions wherein that kind of cycle is what occurs, it can be, you know, in any number of areas. So, I mean, broad-based self-harm.
Right. Right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
And it's also different from, I think, from infidelity. You may have somebody who's compulsively, you know, unfaithful, but that really seems to be, to me, much more of a conscious choice. As the two men here have said, and myself as well, it's a childhood thing where the shame comes from. Southern Baptist here. And so, you know, this is something that's archaic. This is something that you don't necessarily have a conscious choice. I'm going to feel shameful, you know, or ashamed of this, or I'm not. It's simply there, as opposed to infidelity. So I think it's a far more deeper and obviously more psychological aspect to that.
Yeah. It's great.
It certainly blocks energy. It blocks flow of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the other hand, it made it really possible for me to not go further, you know, with women who really were interested in me, and I wasn't. You know, I knew that wasn't going to go anywhere, so I could exercise restraint. But it just didn't happen that way that I could.
Yeah.
Do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I think the distinction there is, whether there are more skillful ways to accomplish the same result, you know. So, yeah.
Rick,
yeah.
Back to what you said, I don't want to wait until the next meeting. When you said that there's a very highly developed culture of visual imagery for men, but there's also a well-developed culture of visual imagery for women.
Sure.
That's growing all the time. It's not as highly developed as the one that we have for men, but there is this similar thing that's increasing all the time.
Oh, I think, I could be wrong, but maybe I probably am thinking of my wife's reaction. You know, the picture of a handsome guy with his shirt off holding a baby in his arms. Oh, that's like porn for women. You know, wow. You know, so, and again, you know, we already did gender a little bit. Let's not redo it here. But sure, definitely true. But the larger point there, whatever the fixation is, it's interesting that when if you just, I'll tell a story of myself. They're the best kind. So I go on retreat, right? And when you're on retreat, as many of you know, and if you've never gone on a meditation retreat, I highly recommend it. As I said to my kids when I came home, nothing is as powerful as nothing, right? Because you do nothing, and it's incredibly powerful. So in that heightened state of awareness, I began to be aware of, you know, my male eyes. And even in a retreat setting, you're not talking to anyone, you're definitely not ogling people, you're not making eye contact, you're unless in a very kind of unusual situation, maybe you're chopping carrots together in the kitchen. But I would watch in the processing stream, because when your mind's quiet, you can see a lot in a second or two. Processing stream would be, the way I would describe it at the kind of monkey brain, is, you know, eyes would be just walking, object would move into visual field, identification, female body part, pleasant, desire, frustration. 2 seconds, suffering, right there. You know, it's a classic chain of dependent origination. In other words, contact, the visual contact, feeling tone of pleasant, craving, clinging, suffering, just like that. And I began just to watch the automaticity of it. And what became extremely amusing to me in a weird way, I was going to say perverse, but that would just be, you know, not cool. But anyway, what became amusing to me was not that my mind would do that automatically, because I think male mind and evolution and then add tons and tons of, you know, socialization in the culture. But what was amusing was that every time my mind went down that tunnel, it still thought there was cheese down it. Even though there was nothing but a trap. There was nothing but suffering, micro-suffering, but still suffering, frustration at the end of that tunnel every single time. So you see what I mean? That's what was kind of really interesting about it. And that's a small example of sexual desire, fixation, and, you know, localization on something that then leads to suffering. Right there. If you think of it, what are the elements there? There's a fixation on something, right? It's very specific, and then there's the grasping after it. So consider the opposite. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, he does the, you know, the five precepts are don't kill, don't steal, don't engage in sexual misconduct, don't lie, and don't, you know, use intoxicants. Those are basically the five don'ts. He turns them into the five do's, and he has different ways of talking about it. So I want to invite you this week to come to, number one, bring mindfulness to the general realm of sexuality. Start watching what your eyes do. Start watching what your ears do. Start watching how you respond. We didn't even talk about the kind of harms that occur when we cut off the sexual energy of our partners or other people unnecessarily, right? And are jarring to them needlessly. That's another conversation to have. But number one, if you can, just try to bring some mindfulness to this. Do an experiment. See, open up. And then number two, think about the opposite of those three conditions. All right? In other words, instead of fixing kind of locally on some sexual stimulus and then working with that in terms of craving, which then leads to clinging and suffering usually, try to open out. Open out into a broad, panoramic, whole body experience of the field of desire and see what that does. Right? Okay? Is that one clear? Instead of fixing and grasping, open out into being with whatever that is. The second thing is, instead of shaming oneself, regard sexual desires as like desires for water or air or food. They're just desires. What they take us to, they're morally neutral in their own right. What they take us to might be morally positive or negative in terms of causing harms or helping, right? But in itself, sexuality is just energy. It's just the body, right? It's the body and the mind working together, maybe with spirit. That's just what it is. It's just flow. So explore that. See, this is the positive, right? And then last, instead of constricting, really try to let things move. One way to have them move is to talk about sex. Consider how you haven't really talked all the way about sex. Or you could say more about sex, and it would be all right, either to yourself with words or into relationships, your relationship. That's one way to have there to be energy to move. Or in your own body, to allow the energy to flow rather than be constricted. Right? So instead of the three don'ts, right, don't fixate, don't shame, and don't constrict, we would have, in effect, three do's, which is do open out, right? Do bless the sexual energy inside oneself and in others, and do let the energy flow. Okay? Right? So explore that. So may you be mindful. May you be open. May you bless, and may you flow. So, see you next week. Thank you. Thank you all.
Should we do anything Friday night?